Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us. Denny, you and I have an important announcement, don't we?
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact, Miss Susan.
Well, why don't you, if we had a drum roll, we could do it, but before we bring our guests on and talk about the holidays and hope, why don't you go ahead and make the announcement?
Yes, tonight marks the last show, Crime Wire show, on Blog Talk Radio. This will be out.
And why is that, sir?
Because we are switching to a new station called Vegas Cool Radio, and our first show there will be February the 7th, and we're going to revamp, and we're, you know, I'm sad in the one sense because Crime Wire has been good, I liked it, but, you know, things happen, it's time to move on, so we're going to be making that move. It was decided on actually yesterday, and we're making the announcement tonight. And we'll be effective February 7th on Vegas Cool Radio, obviously headquartered in Las Vegas.
And we'll be, you know, live out of that studio, which is even more cool because and it's Vegas with a K, or cool with a K. So it's VegasCool, KOOL.com. And what's nice about this is that we'll reach that many more. And I think that people will be able to, you know, interact with us differently, and we're revamping everything, and I'm excited about this. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that certainly makes two of us, and we'll be updating folks through our various websites and blogs and so forth. You know, between now and then, as more details are worked out about the opening show and so on and so forth. We certainly hope our regular listeners will come with us and to
well,
our
those
new
they
network.
Can come with us also. Just, you know, the cases that we're going to do are going to be so important in a different way. And again, the audience and the accountability. So many people have been helped. I think that it doesn't matter where we broadcast from, but we've outgrown Blog Talk, and so that's part of this as well. That's why we're going over there. And, you know, this is also the holiday time. So Denny and I thought that instead of a regular kind of a crime show, because so many people have such a difficult time getting through the crime, getting through the holidays, getting through birthdays, this is a particularly bad time of year for so many people. You know, the internet, you kind of can't, Denny, get away from holiday and happiness. But with the crime reporting and the social media, it just kind of makes it, you know, worse for the victims, don't you think?
Absolutely, and my situation, we lost a daughter several years ago, not to homicide, but I know that, you know, it's a very tough time. Birthdays, holidays, those types of things are very difficult to deal with if you've lost a loved one and a child, I think, in particular. So, yeah, these are hard times emotionally on the survivors.
And one of our guests, who we're going to announce both of them just in a moment, but don't you wish the holiday blues were a jazz song? Not a reality for some people. Me too. Crime victims are particularly vulnerable, especially if their family member has been missing or killed recently or within the past few years. There is no timetable for grief, and that is so true. There is no schedule. There are no true stages to progress through to the end. Like the yellow brick road, as grief is experienced differently by each person, with a multitude of stops and starts, relapses. I mean, that is so right on as far as how we think of it. And I think that our next two guests, Donna Gore, is someone who gives hope. She's got the blog Lady Justice. She's learned her lesson starting back in 1981 when her father was murdered. After 6 long years for justice, the journey she was on turned into a passion for helping others in similar situations. And she was able to transform a negative situation into a positive one, which A lot of times it's very difficult for people to do. Gathering other victims, aiding them through their own traumas. Donna Gore, again, is affectionately known as Lady Justice. She's a regular feature columnist on Hear Women Talk and a contributor to the Times Up blog. And in early 2012, she's going to host her own radio program, Shattered Lives, The Impact of Violent Crimes on Lives of Everyday People. And everybody needs to go to her site, DonnaGore.com. Then we have the my favorite, and I can call her name Tyler because we are long colleagues and friends, and we've been together more years than I can count. And if anybody wants any dirt on me, she can probably give it to you. Jillian Moss-Backman. Jillian Moss-Backman is an award-winning radio personality, author, and life intuitive facilitator. Her work reflects the deepest questions of life. Her groundbreaking work in the criminal justice system embraced the alternatives to juvenile delinquency programs. Utilizing the knowledge along with her degree in psychology, she embarked on her career. Through the years, she has developed her own career with her intuitive ability to assist those who require distinctive, natural healing and knowledge. She's opened a successful spa, a wellness center in Wisconsin. But my favorite part of this woman is that she has a book. She's not just a book. Jillian Moss-Backman is the author of Beyond the Pews, Breaking Away from Tradition and Letting Go of Religious Lockdown. It's an interactive, it really is an interactive book, exploring the presence of divine intuition and how combining it with tradition illuminates the true essence of human beings. And Beyond the Pews is basically headed for the bestsellers list in New York. And her website is JillianMossBackman.com. www.JillianMossBackman.com.
Wow,
yeah, didn't you know that?
That's wonderful. Miss Susan,
so both
are you talking about?
So both of
you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Yes.
And Donna, you know,
yes,
we'll start with you because, you know, when your dad was murdered, it changed your landscape of your life, didn't it?
Oh, it did entirely. Even though I was an adult, I was 26 and fresh out of graduate school and off to my first job, and suddenly, you know, your whole world changes in front of your eyes, and you know, it's like you're back in infancy or something, because none of the pieces fit and you don't know what to do. And now I'm looking at 30 years down the road, and boy, is the perspective different.
Do you think time has changed it for you? Do you think time has made it worse, made it better? Do you wish that you hadn't taken the time to grieve for so long?
Oh, well, I think, you know, the old cliche, the time heals. I think time offers a new perspective, and with time comes maturity and prioritizing your life and making a new life, reinvesting yourself in other things and other people. And I think that's what I've done. And out of all of my family members, we had five family members in our immediate family, and we all grieved in very different ways. And I was the one that was the activist and the advocate, and took it by the reins and attended every court hearing and three weeks of trial, whereas my siblings did it very differently. And I think it's just different in people and different in the way you grieve. But I think having that amount of time, I can say with confidence that I don't know that I would have changed anything in how I went about it, but I'm so glad I did it the way that I did, and I'm so glad that I'm able to help others in the process. That's what this is all about. And so thank you for having me on your show tonight, too. That's part of it. And for everything that you do and everyone at Imagine Publicity, I just love you.
Okay. Denny, you know, you don't talk about this much, but you lost your daughter.
Yes.
And it's been difficult for you, too, to, you know, every year, every day that passes.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't really have an argument with this as such, but I very commonly people refer to newscasters and so forth that the parents or the relatives of a deceased person are looking for closure. And I have a problem with that, because I don't think there's ever closure in that sense where you just, like, it never happened. I think resolution may be a better word, especially for homicide cases. If the perpetrator is caught and so on and so forth, that might bring some resolution to what happened to the victim and maybe a sense of justice. But I don't know if closure ever really takes place. So I tend not to use that term.
I agree with you, Denny. I think that's a misnomer. It's a very overused term. I don't know if our other guest would agree with us, but it just kind of grates on me because it's never closed. It's like an open wound.
Jillian, you deal with so many people who, it's not that they're looking for something outside of themselves. They're trying to pull themselves back in, aren't they?
Yeah, and I'm always taking notes when I talk on the radio because my mind goes so fast. I want to go back to what Denny was saying about closure, and I like his word resolution. And if you break down that word resolution, one of the most important components is bringing back that hopefulness that there'll be a better tomorrow or there'll be a better holiday. And it's one of those really strong, elusive human feelings that everybody has. It's like talking about love. You can't really define it, but you know you can't be happy without it. You can't be fulfilled. You can't feel better about your circumstances unless you have hope back in your life. And I think the word hope itself lends that credibility to the resolution that Denny was talking about. And I think that the word hope expands as you grow and you mature. You know, hope at 21 is an entirely different thing after you've gone through a tragic situation like we're talking about now. Hope means you find a better day tomorrow. You know, it becomes very myopic in its focus. It doesn't become this big pie in the sky, oh, I'm really hopeful that I'll get $1 million. It's more
right.
about, can I be happy tomorrow?
Is it okay to be angry?
Yeah.
What do you say?
Is it okay to be angry, Jillian? Is it okay? Or is it not?
Well, of course. I think anger is a very healthy term that a lot of people bash nowadays. You know, I think anger is our first firestorm that comes up whenever something happens like this. You know, the challenge is how do you get yourself past that fire point where the strike, you know, where the match hits the strike of anger and moving through the process of where you can get to the evolution of hope, whatever that means to you. So, of course, you know, anger is one of those human conditions that I think everybody needs to feel, to be honest.
And it's healthy. I mean, you need to have anger and you need to express it. But I think that if you don't express it, or if you're holding all of your emotions in regarding the circumstances, you know, you might be a very private person. I know of people personally that have a lot more physical illnesses and, you know, medical problems because they don't ever open up or share. I'm extremely the opposite. I'm pretty much of an open book, whether that's right or wrong. But other people I know in this circumstance, you know, you would never know anything about it because for whatever reason, they haven't come to that level of being able to share. And it's not right or wrong. It's just different.
Susan?
Yes, sir.
I have a confession to make. May I?
What? Yes, you may.
Well, I inadvertently activated a call there. I didn't intend to do it, so I put the caller back on mute. I don't know if it's another guest or not, so I'm not sure who it is, but I just wanted to tell you I did accidentally take the caller.
You need to keep your hands out of the cookie touch bar jar here, the switchboard. What are you doing?
Well, I should have blamed it on the dog.
Okay.
Oh. Okay.
So anyway, I didn't drop the call anyway. Whoever it is still there. The thing is, you talk talking about now. Everybody, I guess, grieves differently, and I don't know if there's a you know, an ironclad cast in stone right or wrong way. I've heard of people who, on the deceased person's birthday or holiday, such as Christmas and Thanksgiving and so on, set a plate at the table for that person, and it's like the person is there. I mean, it's at least there in spirit. Other people seem to don't want to mention it at all, and perhaps ignoring it will make it less painful to them or something. And I found, and I'd be curious about the panelists' opinions, when initially after the loss, that friends don't really know what to say to you. In other words, if they bump into you in a store or something, and you might see them even go to a different aisle, hoping they don't have to face you because they're not really sure what to say, how to express themselves to you. And I guess that's normal, I suppose. I don't know, but
I think it's very common. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing. And is there a way you're supposed to grieve? In other words, if you set the table or set a place at your table on holidays or birthdays for the person who is missing, is there anything wrong with that? Or if it works for you, is it the way you should do it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I would label that as a human ritual in the good sense. In other words, a lot of people need to continue those rituals of, that's a perfect example, Denny, of people getting through the process, because in your mind, rituals or little antidotes or things, you know, cooking certain foods for people that and things like that, it not only helps keep them, their memory alive of the person, but it also, in a weird sense, believe it or not, lets them work through the idea that maybe they won't need that at some point.
Right.
And
it kind of holds the family together, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. And people, I think people get kind of weirded out by that. You know, well, what do you mean you set a table for somebody that, and yeah. What people don't understand is the mind works like that.
Mm-hmm.
The mind connects those physical rituals to the whole process of a person to person. So for me, it seems like it would be a very logical and sensical way. And you're right, people don't know what to say. I mean, because
right.
Who teaches them? I mean, we don't. It's like parenting classes. We don't go to classes that say, okay, now when your friend loses this so-and-so, now this is what you're supposed to plug in.
Oh, we need
parenting
classes, though.
Right, and
you know,
exactly.
Yeah.
But isn't it also?
Think,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I just go ahead.
The part of the when you have a homicide, it's, you know, it's very abrupt, and you're not prepared for it. When you have a family member, say that has cancer or terminal illness, you're in a perpetual state of preparation over a period of time. And I think that gives the family and friends and everything a different mindset and a way to different way to interact. And because the nature of this of the passing is violent and it's abrupt, and you know, no one ever expected it. And there, like you say, there is no homicide etiquette.
Exactly.
What to do, right?
But
and,
doesn't it? But it, I think it also applies to a divorce, to a relocation sometimes, to maybe getting older and everybody's gone and you're the only
mm-hmm.
one left.
Right.
You know, I think that that has a lot to do with it, too. I have a friend who's a very, very famous. He's, to me, a walking, talking museum. He is 83 years old. He doesn't look like it. He doesn't act like it. And everybody's gone. So, and he runs circles around most of us. He's got two new books coming out. And I don't know where he gets his energy, but he makes his time valuable. Everybody has died in his life, and he just will not stop being creative, not
mm-hmm.
stop doing projects. And I think it's about our spirit inside
right.
that we're not going to allow it's about believing that tomorrow is going to be there.
Right.
And we have so much pain with someone when they're gone that we can't put one foot in front of the other. You know how I always say, or I say to people that don't get to hear this, the families that we deal with that call in before they come on a show, I say to them, get out of your own way. And I mean it in the nicest sense of stop for a minute. We have to do this show. You need to get out of your own way. And then when I say it takes one to know one, meaning me to them, mm-hmm. then they calm down and they breathe and they say, oh. So they're so used to also not being heard, especially crime victims, especially missing persons. Monica Kisan will say from the missing organization, the Kisan Center for Missing Persons, she will say, you know, that most of her clients, all the missing families are, they don't have computers, they're out in the middle of nowhere, and they don't know what steps to take in filing a continued report to get somebody to search for that loved one. It's been 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, but she does it. They need to be heard. So sometimes at the beginning, people will just keep talking so fast because they don't know if you're going to hang up on them, which isn't going to happen, but they don't know that. They want you to hear because they're the
right.
only recording of a living person.
Right.
It's like
and
the victim impact statement.
They need to have their story told, and that's part of the healing process. And even if you've heard it, you know, a number of times, and you're not there as a friend or family member to judge what they're saying or to say, oh no, that's wrong, or you shouldn't think that way. I mean, you're just there to be a sounding board and to be supportive. And I also think they have other assumptions too, like they think the name of one of my blogs was, you know, after 2 weeks the casserole stopped. Well, people have this idea that, okay, well, you've had this intensity period and it's really tragic, but I have to get on with my life now, so I don't want to hear about it after 2 weeks, okay, because it makes me feel too uncomfortable. And the friends and family stop coming around. And if truth be told, we need the people even more after that initial 2 weeks or month with all of the other aftermath.
But it's hard when the people around, Jillian, say, you don't understand. So sometimes there's a shutout of that.
Right.
There's a go away.
Right.
So how do you get through that with them? Is it exercises of putting happy notes on your mirror, going out and taking a walk, doing something that maybe the person that's not here anymore that you love to do and you can continue to do? Because we stop everything when somebody dies. What we do.
You know, and this idea that we keep relationships from childhood till we die, and that, you know, there is this fluctuation of new people that come in and out of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And when a tragic situation happens like this, one of the defaults, the secondary layers that happen is there are people that come out of your life and they step back. But what people don't seem to get on the second part of that is that when those people step back from your life, it means that another person's going to come in that is more suited for what you need in your life. Think of your life as a CEO of a board, and there's only so many special people that can be in your life to embrace mm-hmm. all of your life experiences. And
right.
so a lot of times people try to hold on to those people that are not able to handle what's going on. And maybe sometimes it's the universe's way of saying, you know what, gently let them go.
Right.
Because
we
somebody
lose friends
will
because
come
they can't.
In.
Yeah, we lose those friends, those ones that can't handle it. But then isn't it, I think it's about building surrogate families too. And, you know, we go on to a new set of people that can take us as we are now because we're irreparably changed as a person.
Denny, yes. When your daughter died, do you think that it was a help that you and your wife were together, that you were able to walk through this darkness together as a team, because we see a lot of people mm-hmm. who aren't married anymore, or they are not together when a tragedy like that happens.
Yeah, we were very fortunate because a lot of people, even if they are together, the loss like that, a traumatic loss, ends up causing separations. I mean, people end up in divorce who were together at the time, but they disagree on the grieving process, for example. And, it, in addition to the loss itself, there's this tremendous stress on the relationship. So, yes, extremely fortunate. And, you know, I couldn't help but thinking, and I maybe I shouldn't say this because I don't want to turn this into a conversation about religion by any stretch. But
I was asking about religion. Do you think that the same faith? I'm in your head, Denny. Same faith was important to moving forward for the two of you.
Extremely, because we were on the same page, if you will. We had, disagreements, differences about certain things, but generally speaking, we were on the same page. But, you know, people I've talked to over the years that have gone through something similar, in many cases they say, well, I believe my loved one now is in a better place. If it was somebody who was sick for a long period of time, for example, they say, well, no longer is there any pain. The pain is gone. And I couldn't help but thinking as we were been talking, what about the people who don't believe in a life after, that they think the physical death is it, that's all there is? I'm just trying to think, if you didn't have, we were talking about hope, if you can't, if you don't believe that, eventually I'm going to be reunited with my loved one, there will come a point, and that they're in a better place, they're happy now, the pain is gone. If you don't believe in any of that, I'm just, it just seems to me there's a big
void. Yeah.
Big void, yeah.
And Jillian, what you put on, Denny, is that Jillian's father was a minister, so besides being the author of Beyond the Pews, I think that you have a really good understanding of this, don't you, Jillian?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Denny. I mean, that is a part of hope in the circumstances what we're talking about. But also, expanded even more, hope for a better day next day or next week. I think, I have to believe that there's some kind of spiritual rock that supports all of this that we're doing. So I agree with what he's saying, is where is the hope if you don't have something to tether that whole ideology of a greater understanding of something bigger than all of us.
Right.
And that's something that everybody has to grapple with.
But you can't see it, so how do you believe it? You have everybody that can't see it, and it doesn't... You're going to have some people who say, well, I'm not going to go to a Bible and read this. I don't believe it. So how do you get them to see the hope? It's not like you can, go take street lamps and put them out on your path and say, okay, hope is lit right here. I can see as I'm walking. They can't see.
It's not tangible.
Well, right. Yeah, but, but then you have to say, okay, but you can't see love either. You can't. There's
I don't agree
nowhere
with you. I think
faith.
You do see love.
That's your faith.
Well,
you have faith that something exists, right?
Right. I mean, but hope is one of those nebulous things like love,
right.
Susan. You
right.
just have to go on the ideology in your head that what you're experiencing is love.
So I'm still a work in progress on that. So I don't know.
Well, what about expectation, though?
Just love in general,
I think sometimes people are so racked with pain. They're so racked in however somebody dies, if they didn't get to say goodbye to them and they die of natural causes,
right.
the worst I think is when you're murdered. I think that, and then the outside course of life, the justice system, other people around you when this happens aren't really very sympathetic, and because that's not their job. So it makes it more difficult because you want to be heard. You want to be want your hand held, and it's really, really difficult. And I think that
right.
I think that people don't offer, you know, how do you cope with this? Artwork is a way to do that. A holiday dinner, maybe you could bring it together by maybe having a toast or a prayer, sending up balloons or messages like that. I'm always
a fan of
planting bulbs, planting something, depending on where you live, but planting something so that it grows in the spring, you know, and keeping it nice or in the house, keeping life around you. So many people punish themselves.
And during the holidays, you know, there is a lot of isolation because people just don't want to, you know, we go into this what I call artificial excitement. Like we all have to gear up for this excitement every year. And it's a very important time in everyone's life, spiritually and religiously. But it's like we all have to feed into the excitement. And if we don't feed into the excitement, there's something wrong with us.
Right.
Or,
and
you
it's
know,
become
we're not
so commercial.
Buying into it.
Yeah.
And so we find ourselves, a lot of people, becoming more isolated. And I really do believe that people are starting to look next door to their neighbors and what can we do. I mean, I think that we're coming back out of our shells. You know, we went so far away into isolation. You know, your problems are your problems, and I'm not getting involved with your problems. But I do see a change and a momentum of going back to a more loving, hopeful kind of sharing existence. And I think you're right, Susan. We're not talking huge amounts of giving to another person. We're talking simple gestures.
Listening to them. You know, and sometimes maybe it's also about volunteering at an organization or, you know, I think too that the social media has changed grieving. It's changed the process.
Right.
Because you're putting your life out there now, good or bad. And sometimes, too, for the homicide survivors, as the trials come up, I saw something a couple weeks ago, and I was kind of, there was this woman who was spitting venom, and her child had died, or grown child had died, and she was demanding that people come and do things for her.
Oh,
like,
gosh.
You know, why can't you do this? Why can't you give me, I don't want to say certain things that might give it away. Why can't I have this? Why can't you take care of me now that my daughter was murdered? Why can't you do X? Like thinking that the system owes them something.
Right.
And I was kind of taken aback by that because I just don't think that the social media teaches Denny grace skills in any way. Do you?
No.
Well, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah.
So Denny, I mean, it doesn't. It seems to add to it. It seems to add this ickiness. And then there are people who, when there are tragedies, these people sit in these forums and throw stones and daggers at crime victims, at survivors of crime.
Yeah. Well, I know tonight we're not doing a specific case, but certainly over the past months, years actually, you know, we've talked to any number of survivors of crime victims and or victims of crime, I should say, and we get a lot of these cases where they not only have to deal with the loss and confront that. And especially if it's a homicide and there's no resolution as far as no one's been arrested, no one's been convicted, and so on and so forth. And then and it could be a year or two down the road. It doesn't have to be at the actual time of the event or closely following the event. The families find themselves confronted with a situation that perhaps law enforcement has dropped the ball. And and maybe a crime scene was botched or something, or and they might never get that resolution. I mean, so now they're dealing.
That's re-victimization. It's what I call it, Denny.
I think that's very appropriate. So, yeah, they're victimized twice. They're victimized by the crime and then again by the system. So now they're
right.
getting it from both sides.
Right. And if there's a delay in the court process, you know, with our trial, because it was a career criminal serial offender, it was a 6.5-year gap between, you know, the initial homicide and the trial. Dr. Pettit had 4.5 years, so it's an awfully you go through it again. You can't help it.
And that's when you start seeing hope go down the drain.
And Jillian,
I
think the churches could play more of a role than what they don't.
Well,
with the families in the community.
Yeah, and all different kinds of spiritual organizations. You know, churches are not the only place where religious and spiritual people go. I think it's a whole group of these people that are needing to be more available to these kind of realities. Because, you know, I have a priest who's a very good friend of mine, and he's a very famous jazz musician. And I'm always saying to him that he's out in clubs all over the world doing his missions to people through his music in the places that people would not go to a religious organization.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to get the idea that the structure itself is a church looks a lot different nowadays. There is a lot of different kind of, you know, proselytizing and helping people with hopeless situations in all different places. And for
so
him,
are you saying that the churches don't necessarily have to have pews?
Yeah, that was great. That's exactly what my book talks about.
See,
you know,
and I haven't even read it yet.
I love it. Exactly, that we have to start seeing, you know, in my book I talk about people that gather in their homes to
mm-hmm.
have meditations and things like that. And I think that's more prevalent than people talk. So when, Susan, when you're talking about the churches, I want to expand it even further than that.
How so?
You know, if these people, because if people say they're spiritualists and they're religious people, you know, there's a group of people that are in a lot of pain in
mm-hmm.
every household in America. And they're so afraid that the pain is bigger than their own spiritual belief, that they're too afraid to act upon it.
But their spiritual belief goes out the window when they're hit with a tragedy, because they say to themselves, how can this be happening to me? I'm good. Why did this happen?
Right.
Why does bad things happen to good people?
Right. I'm talking about, you asked me about the church's role in it, and I'm saying even bigger than that. It's the people that live this spiritual life or religious life to
like
step
a more
in
holistic,
with those people.
A more holistic definition of what, you know, church and spirituality is.
I don't think we know anymore. Denny's one of the few people that I know, and I know that Vito and Tom, you know, we all go to church, but how many people outside of us really go to church? Not a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what the book is about. It's like, but yet, the idea of a religious thought and spiritual thoughts are on the rise. So it's not that the churches are bringing the people in. The spiritual part of ourselves, that soulful living, is exploding.
Is it more of an outreach, Jillian, versus, you know, churches bringing people into their structure? If you go out into the community and you do your good works, you're doing God's work.
Right. And, you know,
what I've seen in my work, you know, Buddhists helping Christians, Christians helping Jews, Jews helping Islamics. It's becoming this circle of sharing and mm-hmm. hope and grace, that there's a group of people that are more concerned about healing the wounded than staying separate on the island.
I love the story about your dad, about how he is someplace else and isn't behind the pulpit as every pastor and minister and priest is on Sunday morning. And explain what your dad does.
Well, you know, I don't want to date myself, but in the book I talk about when Invisible Mike started, and you had a wireless mic, and so he decided that he was going to do his sermon from his office. And so it was just this mesmerizing moment because you could hear his voice, but the pulpit and the entire altar in the front of the church was empty. And, you know, there was no one to focus on. There was no human being. He wasn't where he was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't doing the ritual that people were used to. And it was, I write in the book how fascinating, even at my age, when I was in high school, college age, to watch people's reactions. You know, I mean, half the group was furious with him. You know, you fell down on your duties. You're supposed to be a minister. You're supposed to, this is how you do it every week.
Did anybody walk out?
Yeah, a couple people got up and left because they just couldn't handle changing the system. And then there was another group of people that started to follow in, and they all, and I remember each other looking at each other like, well, what do we do now? You know, if we don't have the person leading the group, I guess we have to look inside ourselves to learn our own lessons here.
And that's where it becomes very uncomfortable, when we have to look inside ourselves. You know, but my question is, when we first have the homicide, and like what Susan said, we can't get out of our own way. So for us to embrace our religion and our spirituality might be like so overwhelming, because we initially feel like God has failed us.
No, God has punished us, not failed us. That I think a crime survivor feels that they're being punished for something that they did, that it's their fault for what took place, because they're good people and they can't understand how this would happen to somebody that was good. You know, it's kind of the thing, how can it be that somebody so good this can happen to? And right. Denny, you know, when you were on the force, I mean, you saw that a lot.
Yes, and the thing I was the most uncomfortable with was if you had to make a notification. Some jurisdictions, the coroner or ME do notifications.
Yeah.
And it's very, very difficult. And mercifully, after, in my case, when Ken was killed, it was a Sunday afternoon. I had the day off, and there's a knock on my door, and it's one of the deputies I worked with. And I'm thinking, you know, I thought it was a little odd. And then I look, and standing behind him is a state trooper. And right away I knew, I said, something was obviously very wrong. And I remember I still can recall today almost word for word, and see in my mind what happened when they actually broke the news. And I always, you know, I said, it's bad. It was bad enough before, but now having experienced firsthand what it's like to get that knock on your door,
right.
I never wanted to have to do it again. I never wanted to have to be the one to bring that news.
And you remember,
I never had to do it.
Because your clock stopped. Your life stopped right there when you got the news.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, it was like, you know, in the old movies where Citizen Kane or some of the older movies where they would throw the sheet or the blanket or cloth over a clock. In reality, what happens is your life stops like a clock. It stops in its tracks. the hands don't move, the second hand stops, and you remember as though everything shut down around you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so horrific because we're not taught or to understand or to deal with a death of any kind, are we?
Right, exactly. No. I mean, it's one of those things we expect everyone to be able to handle because we all know it's going to happen to all of us at some point.
But do we have a reality of that? And I don't think that we do. In realistic terms, I think that we all feel we're invincible at some level, except when we look in the mirror and see how many hairs have to be plucked or how much gray
yeah.
we have or how many times we have to dye our hair or do what we have to do, or when we see us, we see the evolving
imperfections,
of the maturity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nor do I think should anybody dwell on it, though, Susan. I mean, I don't think it's one of those things that you should think about.
Well, and why isn't that built into any kind of curriculum, Jillian? What do you think? I mean, if we all deal with death, you know, regardless of the kind, and even like people that go to school to be a mortician or whatnot, I don't know if they get any classes in how to actually deal with it, but it should be in some kind of curriculum, just like we should have parenting, I suppose. But why isn't it? Because death is so pervasive, and it's part of life. Death is part of life. And there's nothing to teach us.
You mentioned there should be some training or curriculum. Let me tell you where I think is another area that a profession that it wouldn't hurt to have some sensitivity training or training is police. In other words, just as an example, if I buy an appliance or a car or something and it starts giving me a hard time, starts malfunctioning, I want to be able to call the store or the dealership and have the customer service people take care of me and make me feel like I'm somebody and that they appreciate my concerns, you know. And when they don't return your phone calls, you leave a voicemail and nobody ever gets back to you, I get infuriated. Now, you take somebody who's lost a loved one, and they call the police agency, and the detectives refuse to return the phone calls. I just can't imagine, you know, at least if the detective himself or herself is not going to do it per the department structure, somebody ought to be responsible for getting back to these people. How can you take someone who's battling the loss of a loved one, trying to deal with that, trying to make sure the investigation moves forward and the leads are followed up on and all this, and you call and nobody will talk to you? God, talk about a slap in the face. I mean, it's a wonder so many people don't go down there with a gun themselves and say, look, I'm important.
It's another re-victimization. It's way beyond poor customer service. It's unconscionable that somebody would behave that way when you're in that state of affairs. You know, I just can't believe it. It makes me so angry to hear those instances, Denny.
But Denny, I think that's why we have, you know, both our counterparts, Vito Colucci and Tom Shamshak, are both private investigators who were law enforcement, and I think that oftentimes that they are the ones who will work with the families to get them through. And they are the ones who will perform and provide that when things aren't being handled correctly. And so that's an extension of them being on the job for so long that they do work with a lot of those families of the missing, of the unsolved. And they're the ones that have to do that. And they're the ones that have to go back into the department and kind of get the attention of the case so that there is some resolve to it. You know, we have to look at it that way, too, that in the unfairness of it, if it weren't for them, because police can't do everything, because they are overwhelmed, because they themselves have the task of listening to their bosses or the administrators or cost-effective methods of what they have to do every day. And it's not a defense. It's not an excuse. It's reality because budgets are being cut across the country.
Right. And it's not in their training to hold people's hands. I mean, if it comes down to one common denominator sentence, you know, they probably don't think that's their job.
you know, Susan,
I don't know, again, it's for families, and you're right. There should be something, some type of a training for them because the officers don't understand, and it's very difficult. And in
right.
the missing, especially in the missing persons cases, there is a case now, I just found out the other day, that there is no investigator assigned to this thing. They never cared about it. And I'm going to work to see what we can do to get it back on track. It's as if they had looked at this case as a disposable, oh, forget it, don't waste our time. And we see that a lot. And we'd like to believe that the justice system responds better than that. But again, I think it's because of, and it's not an excuse. It's what they are allowed to do. Again, the internet, the social media has changed the landscape of crime from beginning to end, from when it happens to when it gets resolved, or when it gets from the law enforcement or the detective to a prosecutor, because the case has to be made before it can be moved forward. So there's all these steps that people don't see, and they want justice, and they want to hurry up. But the justice wheels are slow, and they're not quick. And when we do see a case like we had on the show where we had James Hensley, when we had Jamie Jones, and his wife was murdered with Tanya Harrington, or Horwath, I'm sorry, and in January, and the trial was quick in August or September. It was over with by September. That there was a very quick resolution where we have, you know, Dr. Pettit, whose family was slaughtered by these animals, and you know it's been over four years.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. the justice. It's the wheels, and that's what people also don't understand. So at the same time, I would say that there has to be more of an explanation to the public.
Right.
And it's different from every state.
It is. And I'd like to give a little plug for support groups, because they do serve a purpose. And I remember, when I first went through it, practically every state has at least our state has a Survivors of Homicide, Inc. And I know Jean Cervantes runs a very good organization in California.
Or the Parents of Murdered Children.
Right. Yeah, there are. And when your family and your friends really don't know how to react, and believe me, it is very hard to walk through that door the first time because you think you're the only one experiencing it. But you talk to your state government, look in the yellow pages, call 211 information. You can find where the support group for the homicide survivors are, and they can become your temporary lifeline to help get you through some of this. And the camaraderie, you know, that you have, there's strength in knowing that there's other people going through it with you at the same time. And you become fast friends with those people. So I would say take advantage of that resource as well.
You know what, Susan, there's one other thing I want to talk about real quick because I don't want to run out of time. You know, one of the really tragic things that happens during this time of the holidays, and we're talking about hope, is suicide skyrockets during this time because exactly of all the things and the components that we're talking about. And I really want to tell people that they need to understand that every soul has a higher mission for service of what they're meant to do here.
What does that mean?
And what it means is there's a purpose for every life that is on the planet. And when you take away that service or that mission through suicide, it means it may never be done the way, in your special way, that it was supposed to be presented to the world. It doesn't matter that there's been 10,000 books written on the same subject that I've done. It's my voice that was the difference. And when you think about suicide, I really want you to go in and understand your story is the most important story that everybody else may never hear. And what Don is talking about with the groups and find the support groups, it breaks my heart when I hear somebody that loses their life because they've lost that hopelessness and hopes for better life, that I will never know the end of their story. I will never be able to know what gift they had to give to the rest of us.
Yeah, the potential.
But that's not something that's conveyed, and for people that do that, they don't care, Jillian.
I know they don't care, but they need to understand that every life has a gift and a story. And
but we don't embrace it. We don't publicize it. We don't honor it.
Right.
You know, we do more to honor something. What are those reality shows? I'm not a fan of them. Jersey Shores and Kardashian. You know, I bought toilet paper today. We look at those things. And we watch them, and we give them life, we give them ratings, we give them, you know, we throw our monies there instead of community, instead of people, instead of family. And we look at stuff, the general public does, to say, well, I'm going to aspire to this, or I'm going to get a boob job, or I'm going to get a nose job, or I'm going to be better, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that. Why not just be yourself? And that's what,
and
we don't
that's what I'm saying is that everybody has a story that needs to be told.
Right.
That I want to know your story. And if you take
again,
your life,
the world
and
looks
take
too big, and
home.
Nobody gives a holler and hoot. And that's where these crime victims and people who lose someone are falling through the cracks. That's where
How can
they're
they get
going.
beyond their grief to understand their value, Jillian, if they're so overcome with their problems? You're seeing it as an observer that they have that worth and they're an untold story. And I think you're true, and it's a very valid point. But I think they can't see the forest for the trees because they're so caught up in their own grief and failures and whatever else. So how do we get them to realize that? I think
you go by the book Beyond the Pews.
Okay.
And breaking away from tradition and letting go of the religious lockdown. We are out of time, ladies. For everybody that wants to go to Jillian Mosbach's site, it's JillianMosbachman.com and then DonnaGore.com. Both of these women are also writers on timesupblog.blogspot.com, where you can read about them every single week. You know, Denny, we're out of time, and at least on this network. So let me do my little part, then you close it up. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, public relations at imaginepublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, February 7th, 2012, at cooljustice.com. Tune in as we will continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
And thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. You can hear a broadcast of tonight's show by going to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website, www.crimewiresite.com. And God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. And although we are moving and going to have a little bit of a different format, our colleagues and associates, Vito and Tom, will still be consultants and experts, and will be on the shows from time to time in that capacity. So you will be hearing from them again in the future. And
I think, too, that for everybody that's listening, you know, if you have a case, you can still email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com, and, you know, that'll give us time to put these cases together for the upcoming shows. And if, you know, people do have a case, they can email us there or email us at timesupforjustice@gmail.com or murphymilano@gmail.com. You know, this is the holidays, and we're coming into a new year. So, Denny, a wise one, close it up.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Have a very safe and enjoyable holiday season. Merry Christmas and good night.
Good night. Thank you both, ladies.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Jenny.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.